Welcome to The Grand Life, a podcast about grandparenting, exploring ways to be better at it and to connect to those who are in it with us. I'm Emily Morgan. What a joy to be back. I have missed our time, but I've been using the time off well. And honestly, I'm so excited about what we have to offer for the rest of the season. It's been 6 months now. We're still in our houses, wearing our masks, wiping down surfaces, and washing our hands. Or are we? We are getting COVID weary. It seems like the last months are dragging with questions looming like, when will we hug or even see our grandchildren again? And when we do, will they even remember us? If you're part of the club sandwich generation, you might even be wondering if you'll see your own parents before it's too late. I know I'm feeling those things and so many others. All the feels, as our adult kids would say. Speaking of the club sandwich generation, I have an update about a couple guests who we featured on that episode last season. Sadly, the woman, Karen, whom we spoke to about taking care of her mom and her young grandson, her mom passed away a few weeks ago. She was surrounded by several generations of her family, and it was a peaceful death. She had lived a wonderful life. In that same episode, we heard from a couple who were anticipating a new baby, and I'm happy to report he was born strong and healthy, and they were there to hold him and visit with him soon after he was born. We are experiencing firsthand in our podcast what it is to be ushered in and out of this world. As celebratory as a birth can be, it is painful being the one left behind when our parents or grandparents die. I don't know about you, but this time alone, the isolation, the inactivity, and the fact that so many elders have died has given me the room to consider a question. Why do I exist? And what does my life, my actual presence, add to my children and grandchildren's lives? Because most COVID deaths are the elderly, exactly what has the world lost? Consider what would be lost if you succumbed to COVID. Heavy questions, I know, but certainly worth considering. In this episode, we explore some of those questions. First, we talk to a woman filmmaker who has interviewed a host of elderly people and asked them questions about their lives. We get a keyhole view into their existence and their tenacity. In our second segment, we review with a professor of psychology why, in his opinion, it's crucial to have elders in our lives. We talk about the generational and cultural shifts that have changed the way we may look at our elderly in America. In The Stretch It Takes, I challenge you to think about the legacy you leave. Is it time to move out of your comfort zone in order to become the kind of person you want to be? Finally, in our new segment called Mind the Gap, where we talk to our adult children's generation, a young woman tells us an inconceivable story about her parents that reminds us of why their story matters and how it affects both her and her children's lives. So let's dive into our first segment and meet filmmaker Skye Bergman. Her film, Lives Well Lived, airs on PBS in May of 2021. It is a warm and inviting film about extraordinary, ordinary, older people, my favorite kind. Skye is a photographer and also a professor at California Polytechnic State University. She shared with me that her grandmother was her inspiration for the film.
I created the movie really because of my grandmother. She was my role model and my hero. And she came to visit me for the first time when she was 96. I live in California and she lived in Florida. And we spent the next four summers, the month of August, she would come out and we would cook and be together. And I started recording her. And I realized that the way that she passed on her love and her wisdom was really through when we would cook together. And thankfully, I went back to Florida with her when she was turning 100 for her big birthday party. And she was still working out at the gym. And I filmed her because I thought nobody's going to believe that at almost 100, she's still working out. And I had a recorder on her and I said, Grandma, can you give me some words of wisdom? And she said things like, be kind and live life to the limits. And that was really how I started the project. I came back from that trip and I thought, I want to find other people out there that are as much an inspiration as my grandmother is to me. Because I was looking at turning 50 years old, you know, the half century mark, and mm-hmm. what was the next half of my life going to look like, and who were some of the role models that I could really have in my life. And so that was kind of how I got started on the film.
I enjoyed seeing all of the people that you interviewed. In fact, how many people did you interview? They didn't all end up in the movie, did they?
Well, I interviewed 40 people with a collective life experience of 3,000 years. So they didn't all end up in the film. Some of them are on the website. And if you go to the Film Stars page on the website, all of their words of wisdom are there. I picked my favorite quote from each person that I interviewed. And it really was truly a labor of love. It was 4 years of interviewing and then another year of re-editing. And so 5 years total to come up with the film.
I am curious because in The Grand Life, we talk a lot about family and we talk a lot about intergenerational relationships. And I'm curious, in your opinion, I mean, obviously you had this wonderful relationship with your grandmother, who, by the way, did pass away soon after you finished the film. Is that correct?
She passed away 6 weeks after she saw the sneak preview of the film. I'm happy to say that we did a sneak preview of the film, and 27 out of 40 people that I interviewed were there that night for an 850-person audience. So she Wow. got to be in her glory and see it, and then she passed away 6 weeks later.
That must have been very fulfilling for you to give that to her. I'm sure she appreciated
well,
it.
Well, I feel like she gave me the gift of the film. So I mm-hmm. was really just, you know, sharing that night with her. And I will say that it's I was smiling so much that my cheeks were hurting by the end of the day or the night.
It's so wonderful to hear you appreciate people who are older. And I am curious, do you think our culture values older people more or less than they used to? Do you have a feeling in your own opinion of that since you've been around people now that are watching this film?
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's become a passion for me is doing intergenerational projects and to connect our youth with elders, because I feel like that is something that doesn't happen as much. I take for granted, or I used to, that I grew up with my grandparents. And one of the things that I learned in doing the research for the film is that the last 100 years is the first time in human history that we've looked to anyone other than our elders for advice. And I really feel the world is suffering as a result. And so it's become kind of a passion of mine to use the film as a catalyst that we show the film to elders and to students, either high school students or college students, and then create a project that goes along with it. So they use the questions that we had in our film, and they get to know each other through a quarter or a semester and then have a big wrap party at the end of that time. And one of the things that's really remarkable is I'll always have students come up to me at the end of that and say how amazing the project was, because they might not have an elder in their life that they can talk to. And they, you know, they may have grandparents, but they may live 3,000 miles away. And so mm-hmm. even if they're still alive, they may not be close enough by that they really can have a relationship with them. And I think one of the things that is such a wonderful find for the students is that they realize that there are so much more commonalities than differences. And really the only difference is the age, but everything else, there's so much in common. So I feel like in some ways I'm combating ageism one connection and one story at a time.
Yeah.
But that's, I think that when we know somebody on a personal level, it's a lot harder to be ageist. And I think that that really helps to bring those generations together.
So during this COVID crisis, do you think that we're recognizing what it means to lose over 100,000 people of a certain generation? I mean, what are we losing when we lose that?
Well, I think in some regard, we're losing a lot of the stories and history that really that generation has and that wisdom that they have, because they've lived through those things. I think that one of the things that has resonated with people as they're watching the Lives Well Lived film through this time is that here's a group of individuals who lived through so many real trials and tribulations, and their resilience in being able to overcome those things is really helpful to look at now as we're all going through this pandemic. I mean, I think one of the people in my film, Evie Justison, talks about Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and how he realized that you can't control necessarily the things that are happening to you, but you can control your attitude about them. And I think especially during this time, that's so critically important. And so the more that we can do to stay connected to people who are on the older side, especially right now, the better that it will be for all of us in the long run.
Mm-hmm. It is a great loss, I think, of these people. And I'm hoping that people like you, I feel like people like you have inspired a lot of people to listen. How can we see your movie if we're interested in seeing it, other than a screening or something like that? What have you got cooking?
Well, if you go to our website, which if you Google Lives Well Lived, it'll be the first thing that comes up, but it's lives-well-lived.com. We are selling the DVD on our website, and it's I'm proud to say that we have captions for it. We have audio descriptions for anyone that's visually impaired, and it's subtitled in 6 languages. So we've tried to make it as inclusive as possible. And also, if you go to our website, even if you don't see the film, you can go to our film stars page and get lots of wisdom there from our elders, because like I said before, I picked my favorite quote from each person that I interviewed, and so sometimes that's a nice pick me up, you know, just to go and look at some of those quotes. I do that every once in a while, although I think I have them all memorized at this point.
Films are a gateway to understanding what we have to offer as grandparents, and educating ourselves is another helpful tool. I talked to Dr. Alan Oda, a professor of psychology at Azusa Pacific in California, about why children need grandparents, or surrogate grandparents, in their lives. I was grateful for his perspective, both personal and professional. Okay, so we are going to ask you questions about what goes on in people's minds, maybe a little bit about what goes on in their hearts, especially children and grandparents. I talked to a filmmaker, Skye Bergman, and she just made a film called Lives Well Lived, and I asked her about whether or not our culture values grandparents and what it is that we will lose now since there are going to be fewer older people due to COVID. I'd like to ask you, as a professor with a psychology degree, what it is you think children miss if they're without their grandparents? I mean, what do we as older people bring to the table to children?
I want to take a step back a little bit on this one, because really the idea of multi-generational families is something that we have had for decades, centuries, all around the world, including the United States. Where we had a rural economy here in the U.S., the grandparents, the parents, and the children all lived on the family farm. You had communities in which all the family were all adjacent to each other's uncles, aunties, so on and so forth. So the thing is that this whole idea of grandparents being in children's lives is actually something that is a lot more common than people think. So we're really in this situation now in which grandparents have become more and more an important part of the family, but to me, it's sort of a back to the future type of a thing. So there are families that rely upon the grandparents, for example, for childcare, because both parents are working. That's something that has changed in the last 50-100 years type of a thing. I also think that it's easier to connect with grandparents because even if they're not physically adjacent, you have the technology. Like we're right now on technology called Zoom, so we can actually see each other and things such as that.
Right.
So it's very easy for grandparents to be part of children's lives than it was maybe even half a century ago. So the thing is that when children do not have grandparents, they miss out not just on the connection of the family in terms of generations, but basically living history. grandparents offer that perspective that parents can't offer because they have experienced things that the parents haven't seen. They haven't had, they get a chance to make some of the things they read in their textbooks or even what they see on TV, they make it more tangible and real for them. And I think that's one of the things I would be concerned about if children do not have the opportunity to get to know and get to spend time with their grandparents.
Let's just hop over for a minute into your own story and your own history with your grandparents. Tell me a little bit about how their story has made history come alive for you.
I did not meet my mother's parents until I was 7 years old, and that was only for one summer, and that's because my mom is an immigrant from Japan. But that left an impact on me because I realized that my particular world that I grew up in was not the only thing that was out there. They lived in a rural Japan. I remember everything from we did not have anything like air conditioning or I don't know if they had even heating or not. We would warm up the bathtub by burning trash in order to be able to take a bath at night. But it was still an amazing time for me to know that's where my parents grew up and also to know that, again, there is another way that life exists.
Yeah.
With my dad's side of the family, my dad is what's known as a Kibei Nisei, which is a fancy term for he was born here in the U.S. but went back to Japan at a very early age. So I didn't realize until just a couple of months ago, which is interesting. My dad's 92 and yet I never heard the story. He went back when he was 7 months of age.
Wow.
So he did not really know his mother until much later on in life. In addition to meeting her and my grandfather when I was, again, in Japan when I was 7 years old, she came to stay with us when I was in, I want to say, the middle high. And she stayed with us for about a month or so. And so she had all these amazing, fascinating stories about their time in the U.S. and some of the things that happened in their lives and so on and so forth. And the one that really struck me was that she told stories of she was with my grandfather and two of my uncles in the internment camps at Gila River in Arizona. And that was where the Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. And she told the story of working with these Mexican farm workers. And she actually knew a little more Spanish than she knew English.
Wow.
And she told the story very quietly. And she just told, you know, she was smiling when she told the stories, but I noticed as she was sharing, a tear is running down her face.
Wow.
And I don't even know if she realized that was happening. I just begun to learn about what Japanese Americans experienced in World War II around that time of my life. And so to hear that story and connect those things together made things very real for me.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing that grandparents can offer. They can offer that kind of living history, as I mentioned earlier, that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do without having that kind of conversation.
Yeah, I love to hear what you're saying because I can hear empathy in your voice, which, you know, we sometimes in this culture, I feel like we're lacking empathy. And so if you have grandparents, you ask them their stories, you can find out about them. And you, like you said, you saw that tear come down her face, and I'm sure you felt for her. You realized what she might have been feeling. That's beautiful. And it actually segues really well into my next question, which I was talking to a millennial, and she was saying, grandchildren exist for the grandparents. That is, grandchildren are there for the grandparents to dote on and to hug and love. But, you know, there's that saying about, grandkids are great because you can love them and then you hand them back when they get fussy or, you know, impossible. You can give them back. And that was kind of where she was coming from. Does that indicate to you that grandparenting is a one-way street?
Oh, I disagree. I think that what the child gains from the experience of the grandparent is as valuable as the experience that grandparents have with children. I think that, as I mentioned to you, children learn about life seen through different persons' eyes. I think that's one of the things that we really underestimate is how the shared experiences that we offer to children and so on and so forth is really, really valuable. And so that's something that grandparents offer to kids. Obviously, the other way around, someone for the grandparents to feel as if they are connecting with the new generation, I think is wonderful. I think it's a mutually beneficial type relationship. And the running joke is that the one reason why grandchildren and grandparents get along so well with each other is because they have a common enemy. There is really something gained on both sides. And sure, family ties can be the ties that bind. I get that. But the one thing that I think also that is unusual in American culture is that we tend to see the nuclear family as being the common model, which is, and this comes back to the history of the U.S. The reason the U.S. expanded from one coast to the other was because you had families who were willing to move away from their parents and other relatives to, you know, the whole cliche. Those of us who are boomers have seen in some spaghetti Western, go West, young man.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So the thing is that they became these independent units, whereas I'm not saying that there isn't value to that. One of the values of the nuclear families, that means these folks were willing to take that chance and do something very different. They were able to have that that cliched pioneer spirit to be able to establish something different, which I think is still very valuable in American history.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think that without having the grandparents as part of that relationship or things like that, they miss out on, I think, that opportunity to have that multi-generational type of nurturing that I think is very important for kids to have when they can have it. I mean, it varies from family to family. And I do know that, again, some grandparents can overdo it. All right. But at the same time, there are also kids who are deprived because of it. It also brings up one other thing, and that is that a lot of kids, particularly of girls, but again, even you see this with boys too. Most girls can think of an auntie so-and-so that they had when they were growing up, or at least some other adult figure that they had in their lives. Mm-hmm. Carol Gilligan points out that one of the reasons why women are more accepting of mentors is because they've been mentored their entire lives. Mm. So they'll be mentored by their grandmothers or an aunt or someone such as that. Whereas men, by comparison, are unwilling to really, or at least really don't know how to bring mentors into their lives until maybe they start working. Then they have someone who can help them with their job to get them started, so on and so forth. And so I think that it's helpful to have those other adult figures in your lives, because as a parent, I know that I'm not perfect, and I can hear my boys in their room saying, you know, shouting the hallelujahs when I say that. But I think to have other trusted adults in one's life is a good thing.
Yeah.
I think it's good to have that other perspective. And sometimes that other perspective can get the same idea you're trying to share with your kids that an auntie or a grandparent might be able to communicate with the child better than I can. One of the things that struck me was that with the whole thing about the current pandemic that we're in, it feels as if it's never going to end.
Right.
And I would argue that anyone who was raised up during a war time type of situation, they're in the same experience. You don't know when a war is going to end.
Right.
And so now, when I was growing up, the Vietnam War did not really cause too much in terms of having to, for example, ration things like, I think in World War II, you had to ration things like sugar and gasoline and things such as that. But there was great political conflict during the Vietnam War back in the 60s.
Absolutely.
We're seeing that kind of polarization now.
Yeah.
And yet, eventually, we came back together.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something that's important for us to realize, that despite how polarized we currently seem to be right now, the U.S. did manage to find itself in a united States type of situation.
Yeah.
And I am at least hopeful that that's what we're going to see after this virus eventually becomes part of our history.
Yeah.
More than the day-to-day type of experience.
You know, in your experience and maybe having seen some different cultures, do you think that we as Americans differ in the way that we look at the older generation? Do we have a different perspective, do you think?
We've always skewed towards people that are younger because, again, of that, I mentioned that whole thing about the pioneer spirit, and these are the folks who are building their businesses or trying to create something new and so on and so forth. So I remember talking to a counselor once that says that the American culture is one of the few cultures that really seems to idealize only 10 years, maybe 20 years of a person's life, like between 20 and 40 or 20 and 30, what was it? I think anybody who's a boomer like me remembers don't trust anybody over 30 was a saying way back in the 60s. And now that some of these folks in their 60s or 70s, maybe they have a slightly different interpretation of things. But I think that American culture is always skewed more towards the new. I think part of it also has to do with our influence of media, so on and so forth, that kind of thing. We view that as people get older, that we think that their ideas become antiquated. But in other cultures, it's the oldest individual who is considered to be the voice of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say Japanese culture is one I'm familiar with. I know that when they look at the rice crop, it's often one of the eldest people in the company that is one who determines that that particular crop of rice is the most ideal for whatever they're going to do. Actually, it has to do with things like making sake, the Japanese rice wine, and things like that. But it is, I think they're called the toji. I could be wrong with that, but he's the one who kind of makes the call of, okay, this is the crop that's ripe for what we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
They have the experience of saying, how do we best grow our crops? How do we best run things in terms of factory and things such as that? And I think that part of it is true because I know that younger folks do see innovation, which sometimes older folk are less likely to embrace. But on the other hand, there is something about the experience that older folks bring in that say that, hey, maybe it was tried before and it didn't work out too well. So I, again, it's that both and versus an either or type of perspective that I think we need to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, I think all of us who are listening are hoping that our children and our grandchildren will consider us wise and seek our advice. I'm not sure that's always going to happen, but it is kind of nice because I think it does give us more of a sense of purpose. The older we get, we feel valued.
If we're fortunate enough to be around when our grandchildren are in their 20s or 30s, I think that's when our experience becomes really valuable to them.
Mm.
Grandparents represent those that learning from the past that can be still valuable today.
Alan, thank you so much for your time. This has been really helpful as we seek our purpose as grandparents, and I think it'll give us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
We've heard from two guests about the importance of the stories we pass down, and while I believe in the power of story, we are more than the stories we tell. We've lost so many over the past 6 months. Many of these people were older, and it left me wondering, what exactly besides stories have we lost? The empty space has sent me on a quest. I've been searching for meaning. Exactly why is being a grandparent an important role? Think about it. Traditionally, we have placed a high value on our elders. Is that over? Some seem to feel older people make up a generation that we could just comfortably do without. Have our elders become a throwaway generation? What kind of gap is left if I, as an older individual, just disappeared? Those are the kinds of questions that have been on my mind and really stretched both my imagination and my heart. Today in The Stretch It Takes, I have a think about it all. So let's go to the mat and stretch our relationship muscles in the service of seeking what we've lost and discovering how to retrieve it. COVID has really changed the trajectory of so many of our lives. Before COVID, most of us were moving in a specific direction with very clear goals and hopes and dreams. We were busy, sometimes too busy. Now it feels like we are each floating in a very small pool with nothing to do but doggy paddle. My arms are tired. How about you? I question myself almost every day. Am I making the most of this life? Have the choices I've already made make it impossible for me to change direction if I don't like the way things are going? Can I be a better self and offer that to my adult children and grandchildren? If this week was my last week on Earth, would it be said of me, as it has of others, that I led a well-lived life? I think I have come up with a few answers. I would love to hear yours. But for the meantime, let me share what comes to mind. I'm thinking there are a few important things to remember in order to live well. Know yourself. We've talked about this several times in the podcast, but most notably on the episode about Enneagrams. In those episodes, we learned that knowing yourself is the first step to making peace with the world and your adult children. It also provides you with some wisdom to pursue healthy relationships with your grands. Pursue your passion. There is a lot to be said for being a doting, devoted, and passionate grandparent, and perhaps you have made that your passion, but try to remember that grandchildren grow up in the same way your own children did. We have seen in so many episodes that hobbies and passions are important to pursue as we grow older. It gives us a way to give back to people, and that is always life-giving. Work hard. It's easy to get lazy as we grow older, both physically and mentally. And there's certainly nothing wrong with leisurely mornings and quiet evenings, but hard work is a way to stay useful and young. Try not to shy away from doing the hard things, learning something new, taking a chance, and failing. Stay relevant. Resist the urge to look at the future in a negative way. You can still appreciate the past without damning the future. Explore what is predicted and what is present. Attempt to look forward, even in conversation. It's important to say yes to what is to come and reserve no in conversation only when absolutely necessary or when you feel your boundaries are being ignored. The older people I most love and admire are people who exhibit these traits. They are young at heart and fun to be around. They have stretched themselves and stayed flexible. They do not have to search for meaning because they have actually found it. I guarantee that none of them have perfect lives, but instead, they have lives well lived. That's the goal. That's the challenge. I would love to hear about people in your lives who fit that description. Please email me at grandlifeconnection@gmail.com or leave me a voicemail at 317-572-7876. Our final segment is something we're calling Mind the Gap. Those who know me know that I'm a little bit of an Anglophile, and in the UK, the British phrase Mind the Gap refers to being careful not to fall into the space between the platform and the train. They call it the tube. It could rightfully work to explain the sometimes equally dangerous gulf that can exist between us and our adult children. It could be a gap in understanding, or in perspective, or even in location. So here's to a new part of the grand life, where I bring in the perspective of the younger generation about whatever issues we're discussing. Sometimes there is a large chasm between parents and adult children. For our next guest, there is nothing but appreciation and admiration. Heather Karazim works full-time and is the mother of three children, two middle schoolers and a toddler. She is a very busy mom. Between parenting and traveling for her job, she gave me some of her time to tell us her story. Or should I say, her parents' story. I invited you here today because I heard a story about you, and actually about your parents, that I found so interesting. And today we're talking about how grandparents pass down a legacy in the form of stories. So I kind of wanted to talk to you because you're the in-between person. You're the one that has heard the story from your parents, and now you're their grandchildren, your children, will hear this story from either you or them.
Yes.
So the story is pertinent, I think, because it kind of speaks to a life well lived. And we're kind of talking about that all today. So go ahead and tell us a little bit of background of the story, and then you can go ahead and just tell us the story. It's so fascinating.
Sure. I was born and raised here in Indianapolis. Grew up in the Butler-Tarkington neighborhood and went through the IPS school system. And at the time, we were living very close to the Riviera Club, which is a well-known sort of swim and tennis club in the neighborhood. It has a very long, history. It was a private club. So obviously you had to be a member. I was born in 1975, so I'm definitely dating myself, but this was around 1980. So I was about 5 years old. And I remember just even then as a five-year-old that there were families who lived on our street that, you know, in the summers, they frequented the Rivi. And, mm-hmm. you know, when the kids were out of school, that's where they would go every day and go swimming. And, you know, it was just kind of a well-known social destination for families, especially in the summer, obviously, with the swim and tennis activities. And Rivi, being that it was a private club, did not allow membership of African-American and Jewish families. And my parents, I learned this early on just by observing, and this is such an indelible memory for me because they have always been just social justice warriors and servant leaders in the community. And I knew at the time that they were involved in a class action lawsuit with some other families in the neighborhood that, you know, took Rivi to court to allow them to apply for membership, even though they were African American or Jewish. Again, I was only five, and so I don't remember all of the details, but I do remember when the case was won and we were finally allowed to go there. I just remember my parents fighting for what was right, and that because other families that we were friends with had the ability to go there and they knew that it wasn't right that we didn't have the ability to go there, it was important for them to fight for that right for us and for other families who wanted to join.
Kind of curious, Heather. I've heard rumors that there was something that happened at the Rivi that actually may have contributed to the lawsuit that happened there. Did you know about that when you were a kid?
I didn't. And I learned much later, actually. I was an adult, and again, I probably learned this about 10 years ago when it was time for my son to learn how to swim, and we wanted him to learn how to swim at Rivi. My mother told me more details about the lawsuit and what it was like being in court. I understand now why she probably spared those details to me, you know, as a child. But she had explained how difficult it was that when she was on the stand, that she couldn't look another mother in the eye or couldn't look in her direction because actually it was a mother of an African-American child who was a friend of another white little boy who had tried to bring him to the Rivi as a guest, and they were turned away. And, you know, the boy was told that he couldn't bring his black friend in as a guest to swim, so they decided to swim in the White River instead. It was very accessible. I just remember the White River being, like, right behind the Rivi parking lot, and they went swimming there, and the black boy drowned. It's a tragedy that clearly could have been prevented and avoided.
In an article dated September 22, 2015, from a publication titled The Indiana Lawyer, journalist Mickey Maurer mused about the memories of real-life attorney Larry Rubin, who was 10 years old in 1958 and also was not allowed to swim at the Rivi. Maurer imagines what Rubin might have been thinking at the time, writing, "All the kids in the neighborhood walk or ride their bikes to the Rivi to swim. All the kids, except for me. Jews weren't welcome." Years later, Rubin filed a class action lawsuit against the Riviera Club under Title II of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Mike and Karen Rodman, Heather's parents, were among the families who joined the fight.
My parents are also very quick to say that while they were involved in the lawsuit, there were other families, you know, that were a part of that. This wasn't anything that, you know, the Rodmans did. This was, you know, collective families who came together to make this happen.
I was curious to find out from Heather if her children had heard the story and from whom.
We talk about it now. In particular with my son, because he is older and he understands. He's also very much an old soul and has such emotional intelligence and empathy that he tends to take the weight of the world on his shoulders a bit. And I think in light of everything that's going on in the country right now with racial injustice, we've had some pretty difficult but important conversations about what's happening and how, you know, I remember sharing with my son that I had a conversation with my mom around sort of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, my mom just being so devastated that it seems like we've taken so many steps back. And she talked about how what they fought for in the civil rights movement and, you know, back in the 60s, and how you'd think we would have made so much progress and maybe we hadn't, and how hard that was for her, you know, to process. And she talked to me about how hard it must be to have a, you know, be a mother at the time in the 60s. She didn't have children yet. And so I think she was really empathizing with me to say, you know, I feel so bad that you're having to have these conversations, you know, with your children. So Ben knows the story about Rivi, and he knows the role that his grandparents played in that. It's easy to remember maybe the negative history behind it, but I choose to see the positive. And I think about how far, you know, the club has come, and, you know, the neighborhood, I think, is, you know, even maybe more diverse than when I grew up, and to see the families that are there, it does put a smile on my face to think that, you know, my parents had a part in that. You know, they made this happen. I remember, and this is probably as an older child talking to my father about it, and I remember him distinctly saying that it wasn't fair and it wasn't right, and that it was important to make it right. What's interesting about that is that my dad will go to the Rivi, but he won't set foot in the pool. And for him, it was, I fought for the right for us to have the ability to do it, and for you and my grandchildren and others. But for me, just based on principle, it's not something that I want to do. It's too painful. My mother, on the other hand, agrees and respects that decision. But for her, she goes there every morning and takes a water aerobics class. And I think in her mind, and she has said this, that we fought for the right to be there, and they're going to see my face there every day. And what's interesting about that is that being a product of both of these individuals, I totally understand both of their perspectives. When it was time for my firstborn child to learn how to swim, I wanted him to learn how to swim at Rivi. Yes, it's a wonderful place to learn how to swim, and they have a very competitive, you know, swim program. But again, for me, it was more based on principle that my parents fought for us to be there and to have access to that place. And so I wanted to continue sort of that legacy.
The Rodmans, as a Black family, and Larry Rubin, who was Jewish, worked hand in hand to advance civil rights in Indianapolis. Remember the article I mentioned about Larry Rubin? It was written in 2015 on the occasion of his death. Mickey Maurer's article was an appreciation of his long career in the law, and he imagined how fulfilling it must have been for Rubin to see the results of that hard-fought battle for equality. In the voice of the late Larry Rubin, Maurer writes, "When I pass the Riviera now, after a long career in the law, I hear the shrieks of joy from the boys and girls who are enjoying a swim at the Rivi, including Mike Rodman's grandson. I still get a twinge." Once you've heard the story, it's hard not to feel the same way. Stories like these, the ones passed down from generation to generation, are like connective tissue for our collective body. In biological terms, the major functions of connective tissue include binding and supporting, protecting, insulating, and storing reserve fuel. Think about how that simile translates to our own families. In our families, those repeated stories do just that. They bind and support us, protect us from making the same kinds of mistakes. They insulate us from tragedy and pain, and they help us store up a reserve to get through things like this COVID pandemic. I wonder what your stories are and how they have done that for your own loved ones. Feel free to share them on the Grand Life Facebook page. Write to me at grandlifeconnection@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 317-572-7876.
Next time on The Grand Life.
You have to work to earn money. It's not always going to be handed to you. And then once you earn it, you really need to consider how you spend it.
That's next time on The Grand Life.
As I always say, I do not pretend to be the best grandparent ever, but I will confess to believing that being one is the best thing ever. I'm Emily Morgan, and thanks for joining me in Living the Grand Life.
This podcast was written and hosted by Emily Morgan, my grandmother. It was produced and edited by Mike Morgan, my grandfather. Email them at grandlifeconnection@gmail.com.